Welcome to Dominican University of California's Borowski School of Business, Institute for Leadership Studies. Imagine the length of the business card that we have to have with that. My name is Denise Lucy, and I'm very proud to welcome you today. I'm the executive director of the Institute and a professor of business here at Dominican University, and we have a wonderful program for you this morning. And I'm so appreciative that you got up so early and we weathered the storm, and it's really going to be worth it. So our Business Edge Breakfast Briefing is partnered with the Cynthia Murray's amazing North Bay Leadership Council. Does everybody know Cynthia Murray? Yeah. Yes! I want to hear it. I want to hear an applause there because we love Cynthia. But before we welcome you, Cynthia, what we'd like to do is just remind you that we have been offering these programs for many, many years now, and it's the goal is to ignite innovation, to support business, to find new ways to work with your colleagues and to reach out to clients. So we have an amazing program for you this morning. Before I announce Cynthia, I want to recognize our partners. The Bank of Marin is our sponsor. Thank you, Bank of Marin. As I was saying to them, the entire Bank of Marin is here. They have banker's hours this morning. I'd like to recognize Corrine Pinney, who's the first vice president, and Charlie Clifford, who's the senior vice president of Bank of Marin. Please give us applause for Bank of Marin, which is our community bank, and we can't thank them enough for supporting us. Without their help, we really couldn't do it. We have partners in the room as well that help us make sure that the Business Edge Breakfast Briefing happens. The Small Business Development Center, Miriam, wouldn't you stand up, Miriam? Miriam Hope Correll is the director. And the SBDC is inside our business school. This is the SBA program that provides support to businesses to launch and to grow. And Miriam, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your support. And please make sure you check that table out because it's an opportunity of a lifetime. Okay. The San Rafael Chamber of Commerce is also our partner. And I'd like to acknowledge Carolyn Bopp. Thank you, Carolyn, for being here. Can we please welcome Carolyn? Thank you for offering your support to us and partnering. Carolyn, do you have something to add? Thank you so much. Also on our campus in the business school for, I'm going to say 15 years, the U.S. Department of Commerce has the Commercial Service Bureau here. And Elizabeth Krauth is the director. And Elizabeth, would you like to stand, please, and be welcomed? Yes. So the U.S. Commercial Service helps businesses export. So let's do that. Let's do that. The Marin Economic Forum is here today. Mike Blakely, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate it. And they are our partner. Cynthia Murray is going to moderate for today's program. Cynthia is the president and CEO of the North Bay Leadership Council, and she serves on many boards and organizations, including, and this is a list, I don't know where if you sleep, Cynthia. She is on the Bay Area Council of Economic Institute, the first five Sonoma County Commission, Sonoma County Health Action, the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, Marin School to Careers Partnership. She has received the 2010 Women in Business Award from the North Bay Business Journal for her achievements in economic development. And prior to that, being the CEO of the North Bay Leadership Council, she was a supervisor at the County Marin for
8 years,
Cynthia. That's enough. Yeah, one more thing. 7 years on the City of Novato's council and 1 year as mayor of the City of Novato, and it's my pleasure and honor to introduce to you Cynthia Murray.
Thank you, Denise. Thank all of you for coming. I am absolutely delighted to have Carrie with us today. This is going to be a real treat for me personally, and I'm sure for all of you, because she is an amazing woman, and for her to come and speak to us today is a real honor. Kara Golden is the founder and CEO of Hint Incorporated, a healthy lifestyle brand that produces the leading award-winning unsweetened flavor water, as well as a scented sunscreen spray that is oxybenzone and paraben-free. Kara's received numerous accolades. She makes my list look like nothing. It includes being named EY Entrepreneur of the Year 2017 for Northern California, one of Fast Company's most creative people in business, Fortune's most powerful woman entrepreneurs, and Forbes 40 Women to Watch Over 40. The Huffington Post lists her as one of six disruptors in business. Pay attention to that disruptor, because it's going to be a really interesting point she talks about. None other than Steve Jobs and Mark Zuckerberg. Previously, Kara was VP of Shopping and E-commerce Partnerships at AOL, where she helped lead the growth of its startup shopping business to a $1 million enterprise. Kara is an active business speaker and writer, and she goes everywhere. So you don't know how lucky you are to have her here today. In 2016, she launched the Kara Network, a digital resource and mentoring platform for entrepreneurs. She also recently launched the podcast Unstoppable, where she interviews founders, entrepreneurs, and disruptors across various industries. Students, I hope that one day you get to be on her podcast. Welcome, Kara Golden.
Can you guys hear me? Yay! So excited to be here. And I'm also a mother of four teenagers, which it, like, actually walking out the house today and trying to juggle cars when one of the cars is in the shop was just, I mean, God forbid that the 17-year-old doesn't have a car to drive today. It was like, So anyway, we figured it out. So anyway, how many have heard of Hint prior to this morning? So, yay! So, super, super exciting. So, I'll tell you a little bit about my background and just kind of where we are today more than anything. So, I started the company almost 14 years ago now, which is crazy. Time flies. Whenever I'm speaking on college campuses, I always tell college students that I never wanted to be a beverage executive. I've talked to a ton of entrepreneurs that are out there that have said, I want to start the next Red Bull or Vitamin Water, and that was not me at all. Anyway, when I left college, I went to Arizona State University. I grew up in Arizona. Was a sun devil, so grew up there and left Arizona State thinking, I wanna write, I wanna disrupt. I was a double major in journalism and finance. And I got on a plane and moved to New York City because where else do you write? And crazy story, I actually marched into the HR department after writing a letter to a guy, Marshall Loeb, who was the editor of Fortune magazine. I marched into the HR department, this was before all the security and the bottom level, and I said, I want to be a writer. They didn't know what to do with me. And, you know, I said, I got this letter back from Marshall Loeb. Of course, Marshall probably didn't write the letter, but I refused to know any better. And got the poor receptionist in the HR department in the Time Inc. building said, I think they were just writing you a letter saying, like, if you're ever in the New York area and you ever want to apply, but I decided just not to really pay attention and just go in and say, I'll take a job doing anything in this building. So I ended up getting a job not in the editorial department, but in circulation, which I didn't even know what circulation was, even through my interview. Does anybody know what circulation is? So subscriptions. So the best way to describe it is the blow-in insert cards that went into magazines. So it's probably one step above the mailroom. And but that was fine. I was willing to take it, and my goal was eventually to get into working at Fortune magazine. So that never happened. I was managing eventually something called airline circulation, which put copies on board shuttles. I didn't really know what unions were or dealing with, you know, large unions inside of JFK Airport and Logan Airport. A girl from Arizona just walked in and just decided to have meetings. And eventually I ended up getting a call from a guy named Ted Turner, who had heard about what I was doing inside. You know, I'm 24 years old. I'm, you know, living in New York City, having the best time of my life, making $24,000 a year, trying to survive, but having, you know, I think my first apartment was 250 square feet, but it was awesome. I loved it. And anyway, this guy, Ted Turner, called me and he said, "Do you know who I am?" And I said, "Yeah, you started this company called CNN." And understand, this is the early 90s. This is before the Gulf War. And he was, I think, amazed that I actually knew what CNN was. And I said, "No, you actually helped me to understand what's going on in the world, because I'm never home before 6 o'clock at night, when the news used to, you know, only be in the morning and at 6 and at 10 o'clock. And so he invited me to come in to CNN and talk to them about this idea that Ted had for putting monitors inside of airports. And somehow he made this connection that I'm running airline circulation. I knew all the right people. He said, "Would you be interested in running this thing called called the Airport Channel?" And helping me write a business model in his, you know, great Atlanta accent. And I thought, you know, I think he's married to Jane Fonda, so that maybe eventually I'll end up meeting Jane, and that will be really cool, and I'll go, you know, work for Ted. And I noticed up front that he was this guy that just had big dreams and big idea and big vision. And I thought, I don't know, I really like what I'm doing at Time. I had sort of grown to enjoy this whole circulation and the analytics behind it. But I thought, you know, he's just a little bit crazy, and he might be really fun to go work for. So I did. And so I took a job at CNN. If you're ever in airports today, sitting there waiting for your plane and those monitors, that was what I wrote the business plan for, and ultimately got them into JFK and Logan, were our first airports. So met my husband in New York, and through some mutual friends from Arizona. He was going to law school at NYU, and I think he saw that I was just always having a great time and sort of enjoying what I was doing, working, and really passionate about, you know, what I was doing every single day. And he graduated from law school and said, "I don't even know if I want to be a lawyer. Like, what am I doing?" And I said, "Well, what kind of law do you want to do?" And he said, "I want to do technology law, where, you know, we're really like focused on things like, you know, URLs and, you know, who owns the rights and all this stuff." So after a number of interviews, the two of us finally decided he needed to come to Silicon Valley in San Francisco. And so that's how I got to the Bay Area. Just he put a ring on my finger and said, "Come on out." And I said, "Okay, fine, I'll go for 1 year, and then I'm going back to New York." And that was 25 years ago. I'm still here. And so we came out here. He was loving what he was doing. I wasn't really looking for a job. One day I was reading the Wall Street Journal. I still had a big interest in finance. You know, one other thing I always tell college students, one of the smartest things that I did in college was actually take finance classes, because it scared me. I hated, I used to say I hated finance, but the real issue was that I just didn't get it. I didn't understand finance. And it's probably, we'll get to this in a minute, but it's probably the best thing I ever did, and why 14 years later I'm still running my company as a founder, which is extremely unusual, because I can actually read a balance sheet and do all the things that lots of CEOs and founders can't do. So was really interested in finance, ended up reading one day in the Wall Street Journal about this guy, Steve Jobs, and another huge visionary. And I thought, you know, this guy is also, I like to work for crazies. Like, I like to work for people that have these big ideas that seem so impossible. And three guys had worked for Steve at Apple. There was an idea that is actually not talked about too often. It was a project inside of Apple that was Steve's idea called En Passant. And they were taking catalogs and putting them onto a CD. And so I was living in a time where I was trying to do research for jobs out here in San Francisco. And the systems were just really slow. They were just very text-based. There were a couple of services like Prodigy and CompuServe, if anyone remembers those services. It was dial-up. You couldn't be on the phone at the same time, like all of those things. And so Steve had this idea that if they were graphically, in order to make the internet grow, it really needed to be much more graphically interesting. Not surprising now that, you know, all the things that we know about Steve. And I said, gosh, he's so right, but how do you do this? So his concept was to put all of these graphics onto a disk and then tell the consumer, just keep loading the disk into the machine with updates. And so that was the 90s. Like, for those of you who were on the internet back then, I mean, it was just about, like, you kept getting these updates and on these disks. So again, I wasn't really looking for a job. I just decided that San Mateo was relatively close to San Francisco, where I was living. So I would just pick up the phone and call the guy that was quoted in the article in the Wall Street Journal from this little company, Two Market. So it was En Passant inside of Apple, and then it became Two Market. And I went and had lunch, and there was another guy named Steve who was there. And I said, oh, do you work for the company? And he said, no, I'm their number one investor. And I said, what's the company what do you do? And he said, besides invest in companies. And he said, oh, I started this company called AOL. And it was Steve Case. And I said, oh, like, he said, have you ever been on AOL? And I said, no, I don't really like these services very much, like Prodigy and CompuServe. They were actually killing AOL at the time. But I said, unless things get really graphically interesting, like, you don't have me, right, as a consumer. And so so he said, he turned to the three engineers that were working on this project that had been inside of Apple, and he said, you guys should hire her, because she actually is your potential consumer and somebody that could actually get really excited about this product and help you. So they did. I started making more money than $23,000 a year and got something called equity. I didn't really understand what that was, but pretty quickly started to get a hold of that as well. And suddenly, 6 months after working for the company, AOL acquired us. And I found myself on a plane. I was living in San Francisco at the time. I live in Marin now, but I was commuting from San Francisco out to DC on the 6 a.m. flight on United every single week. And after a couple of years and thinking, my husband was at Netscape. He was their first, he went in-house counsel for a while in the city, and then he was their first intellectual property attorney, and was loving his job too. But I never saw him for next few years. Somehow along the way, I ended up getting pregnant when I was in 1999, had my first daughter, and then was pregnant with my second child. And that year, I had traveled 320,000 miles. The pilots on United knew who I was. I mean, it was really bad. It was not normal. And so I said to my team, we were at, like, you know, 900 million in sales. And I said, when this thing crosses over to a billion, I'm done. And so then people started asking me, like, when are you done? I mean, we're at $1 billion. And I said, you guys don't want me here anymore. Okay, fine, I'm gonna go. And, you know, another thing really hit me pretty hard. I had lived in New York, and again, I have, you know, my heart really, it's where in many conversations I say I really grew up and figured out who I was and really loved New York a lot. And when 9/11 hit for me, I had some friends that were a part of 9/11, and it really hit me hard. And I thought, if I want to figure out what I really want to do in my life, now's the time to do it. I've got two young children, found out that I was pregnant with my third child, and basically said, I want to do something that really helps and disrupts in some way. And whenever I was sitting there talking to myself about this, or talking to my family, or talking to my friends, I thought that that was a nonprofit. And so I was searching for the perfect nonprofit. I invested in a few different opportunities, and then really just was probably the biggest problem for me with nonprofits, as much as I love them, as I loved a lot of them. So I couldn't sink my teeth into just one. And then the other thing was that the pace that I had been on in the 90s and just building AOL was, it was just crazy. And I've found that, you know, I'm really a builder. I like to move things along. If they move slowly, that I get, you know, very disinterested, probably ADHD somewhere in there. But anyway, I really you know, decided, okay, I'm searching for that thing, and kept looking for it. And while I'm doing that, I'm also going to get in shape. I had these three babies and really looked at, you know, how do I lose weight? I'd been a competitive gymnast my whole life, so I had trained. I knew how to do that. I started back running a lot. I started shopping at Whole Foods. I figured that if I shopped at Whole Foods, that I would just get healthy, right? Like I bought into the whole plan that they were selling, and maybe Trader Joe's along the way as well. And basically nothing worked. So I didn't get in shape. I probably gained weight. I ate more. I was eating healthy, but there were lots of issues that were going on. I was also exhausted. I kept saying, like, I wasn't this tired when I was working. And then the other thing is, I had developed this terrible adult acne that I couldn't really put my finger on, and went to a bunch of different dermatologists. Nobody had any, you know, great ideas. I didn't want to go on some of the drugs that they were telling me to go on. And finally, I decided I really want to see if I can really get to the bottom of this and figure out, like, why can't I lose weight now? Why can't I get my skin healthy? And why can't I get my energy back? So I finally settled on a doctor who was out on the East Coast. And he seemed to, you know, really understand how the body works, how my system was working, and suggested to me that I had had babies too close to one another, that my hormones were out of whack, my metabolism slowed down as I aged. And so the only way to really fix it was to take medication. And so I thought, oh, that's really interesting. I mean, I don't know if I want to be, I'm in my mid-30s at this point. I don't know that I want to be on medication for the rest of my life. And so prior to actually taking any of this medication, I came home and opened my refrigerator, stared at the refrigerator. Does anybody ever do that? And so, like, think, okay, what is it that's in here? And decided I was really going to get religious about reading ingredients and see if it was something in there that was actually causing this problem in my health. And for me, food was actually pretty simple to kind of get under wraps. One day, I looked down at probably my favorite friend. I think I may have actually loved it more than my husband or my, you know, kids now that I look back on it. But it was a product called Diet Coke. So Diet Coke for me was, I loved Diet Coke. Like, I never knew how much I loved Diet Coke until I actually threw it away. I mean, it was part of my day. I not only enjoyed drinking it, but it sort of, like, if I didn't have it in my hands, I felt like I was, like, naked in some way. Like, it was just a vice that I always had with me. Thinking back, I probably, my mom didn't drink as much Diet Coke as me, but my mom played a ton of tennis, and her thing was Tab, if anybody remembers Tab way back then. And terrible, right? I didn't like the taste of Tab, really, but for me, Diet Coke, I thought, you know, it's healthier than drinking regular Coke. Again, I grew up in Arizona. I should have been drinking a ton of water, and I wasn't. Instead, I had gotten my consumption of Diet Coke up to, you know, on a bad day or a good day, depending on how you look at it, up to 12 cans a day. I was, you know, sometimes it wasn't cans, sometimes it was like the fountain sodas. We used to have those at the at AOL in particular. And, you know, it's funny how nobody tells you when you're like their boss, right, at AOL. I had 200 people working for me. Not once did anybody say, wow, you drink a lot of Diet Coke. Instead, they used to tell me now, they tell me, we used to be afraid, like if we were in meetings with you and you didn't have your Diet Coke, like somebody run and get her the Diet Coke or it's like not going to work out well. And so anyway, I decided to throw the Diet Coke in the garbage. I decided if I was really going to stop, I was just going to do it. I wasn't going to wean off of it, or, you know, I had this mindset that I was just going to stop. And my husband kind of chuckled and said, I'm not sure that you can really do this. And, you know, then there was another bar, another challenge that was set for me. And the next two and a half weeks were terrible. It wasn't just headaches. It was, I was going through a real detox that was real. My stomach, you know, I felt awful. I mean, the worst case of the flu ever. And then 2.5 weeks later, I got through it. I noticed I had lost some weight. My skin had totally cleared up. I had lots of energy, and I hopped on the scale, and I had lost over 24 pounds in 2.5 weeks. It was like reset. And then I, you know, again, this was like almost 15 years ago now. And friends would see me and they'd say, what have you done? Like, do you eat anymore? I mean, all the comments, you know, were coming back to me. And I said, I definitely do. It was really strange. Like the food, I didn't really change that too much. But the Diet Coke in particular was just, I mean, I just couldn't believe it, right? Like if it was that easy, if somebody would have just told me to stop drinking diet soda, then I would have stopped a long time ago. But I really thought about, like, why was I so attached to this product? And I thought, first of all, the word diet for me was like, you know, I had been marketed to. I had been told that this thing was like actually better for me in some way. And again, you know, the sweetness. I mean, now I'm friendly with the people at Coca-Cola, and I can tell you that the sweetener today is stevia. Stevia is actually 12 times sweeter than the Diet Coke that I started out with when I was 13 years old. And so what that does is actually trick the brain into basically an addiction. And so so I look at the soda companies today as not too far from, you know, the Philip Morris's of my time, and sort of really tricking people, you know, to believe that they're actually doing right. So basically, I was, you know, drinking water in exchange for my Diet Coke for about a year. And one day I said, I really am craving something with just a little bit more flavor in it. I started slicing up fruit that was on my counter. I was always just really big on fruit, and started throwing it in the water. And what I found was that the pitchers that I would put the slices of fruit in with water, they would last for about a day. And then I used to say they'd get smeggy looking. I don't know if that's a word. But that was my word, and I thought if somebody could actually just bottle this product, then I could pick it up from where I was getting a salad, or, you know, from my favorite place that I was frequenting, Whole Foods. And so one day, I was still living in the city, one day I went into my local Whole Foods on California and Franklin, and I started talking to the guy that was stocking the shelves, and I said, listen, I want something that is water with just some fruit in it, and I don't want any preservatives in the product. I've been making my own at home, and don't want any coloring. I don't want any sweeteners in it. And he said, oh, I have the perfect product. It's called Vitamin Water. And what I realized is that Vitamin Water, you know, 14 and a half years ago, had more sugar in it than a can of Coke. And so I turned the label around and felt like I was educating him. I mean, the guy at Whole Foods, right? Like, you're supposed to know all this, you know? And he, you know, he was amazed at what I was telling him. And he said, are you a nutritionist? Did you used to like work for the soda companies? And I said, no, I'm a tech executive. Maybe I'm, you know, worked in circulation. I mean, I have no idea what I'm talking about. And he said, gosh, that's really interesting. I've like gained all this weight over the years and, you know, I haven't felt that great. And he's like, it's so crazy that things can call themselves water. And like you actually think like they're healthier. And then you add the word vitamin on there and your brain actually thinks that it's healthy. And I was like, I know, like my issue was diet. Right? That I thought all of these things that said they were diet, that there was, you know, some group that like actually blessed, you know, those words and it made it real. And so again, like the dialogue was so interesting. Came home, talked to my husband and my little kids and said, you know, I was talking to the guy at Whole Foods and my husband's like, you really need to go get a job. Like, I mean, this is crazy. Like, you know, and every day I would come home and I'd tell him about the guy at Whole Foods and he's, you know, kind of looking at me. And I said, okay, I've got it. I think I know what I want to do that can really help people. I want to create a drink that does not trick people into believing that it's healthier than it is. Like there's all these healthy perception products out there versus healthy reality. And he said, he's listened for a few minutes. He said, so what's the name of this product? And I said, it's called Wawa. And he said, you've definitely been living in, you know, kid land for way too long. He was like, why Wawa? And I said, so when you try and get your kids to drink something besides juice, you call it Wawa. He said, no, only you do, maybe a few other people. Nobody else does that. And so I said, okay. And he said, just keep talking to me about this idea. And I said, just fruit and water. You know, there's nothing wrong with carbonation, but that's not going to allow me to drink too much because if you drink too much carbonation, you're not going to be able to drink as much water as you're supposed to drink. And he said, so like, just keep talking about it. And as I went on, I said, you know, just we're giving people hints, just a hint of flavor. And he said, so like hint. And I said, hint, that's it. It's called hint. And he said, so it's a four-letter word. Remember, he's the attorney, and you know, he's like poo-pooing on this whole idea of the word. And I said, so, you know, actually, I'm not very happy with you right now because I really did like the word Wawa, and I don't care that there's this massive chain in Pennsylvania called Wawa, and, you know, and you need to just do your job right now as a lawyer and file the four-letter word. And he said, okay, fine, I'll do that for you, but you're never going to get the trademarks on it. By the way, we have worldwide trademarks on the word hint, so don't listen to your lawyer all the time or happens to be your husband. And I also said, also trademark drink water, not sugar, because that was really my mission, to help people enjoy water without anything else in it. And again, he wasn't my favorite person at this moment, so I thought that there was no better time to actually tell him that I was pregnant with our fourth child. So, didn't know how to like drop that bomb on him. And so he walked out of the room. You know, he said, "Okay, so there's another kid. We have four kids under the age of six, and you're starting a beverage company. You're a tech executive that's getting recruited." Wow, like on a lot of levels, like who did I marry? And he walked out of the room and I wasn't sure if he was gonna come back. He did, he came back in the room and he said, so what's the next step? And I said, so I've written the business plan. He said, when did you write a business plan for this? And I was like, oh, I've kind of been thinking about it, and I just hammered it out. And I have this bottler in Chicago, it's a female founded bottler. And you know, he's like, you like actually figured this out already? This is crazy. I said, yeah, I'm taking a flight tomorrow and I have childcare all set up, but I'm not feeling that great. Like, it'd be really great. Do you want to come with me? Like, it'd be really great if you could come with me and see how this is happening. And he's like, well, did you have to put any money down? And I said, yeah, no, I had to put like $35,000. He's like, you wrote a check for $35,000 out of our bank account to do this crazy like beverage idea? And I was like, I know, like it's kind of crazy, but I'm really passionate about it. And if we could get people to really enjoy drinking water, then I think we could actually change things like national healthcare systems. Nobody would even be talking about that if we actually got people to really understand what they were putting in their body. So he said, fine, okay, I'll come with you to Chicago. And I think when he saw the bottles rolling off the line, he really realized that this was something really big that would be really exciting, and we could, you know, really help lots and lots of people. That was sort of, you know, a high point in the journey. The next point was actually getting the product and getting it into places like Whole Foods. Again, you know, I didn't have any background. Full disclosure, my dad had actually started a company inside of a large company called Healthy Choice. So as a little girl, my dad was always cooking up different things for the Healthy Choice products with a lady named Julia Child. And I had no idea who she was other than she drank a ton of red wine in my kitchen. And I was like always like watching, you know, my dad drank a lot more red wine whenever Julia was over. And so anyway, so I'd had some sort of, you know, going back to my roots of I guess, food in some way. But, you know, when I asked my dad, actually, how do I get distribution, he really couldn't answer that because, again, he had been working for a large company, ConAgra. He had sort of figured out how you get distribution. So I went back to my local Whole Foods, actually did it on the day that we got the product, the initial product, the day before my son Justin was born. I was having planned C-section. I woke up on the morning. I was supposed to be at California Pacific at 2 in the afternoon. And my husband said, what do you want to do this morning? Thinking, go to brunch or sleep in? And I said, no, let's go to Whole Foods and let's see if we can get it into Whole Foods. He's like, you're crazy. So he went with me, carried the cases in to Whole Foods. And the guy was somewhat obsessed with the idea that a pregnant woman was actually coming in and I was delivering in the afternoon. And I educated him all on planned C-sections and that you actually have a time to come in. And he thought I was going to deliver in the store. And I somehow I threatened not to actually have the baby in the store as long as he actually put it on the shelf. And my husband was, you know, totally embarrassed by this whole conversation. And we went down into the parking garage and left and had Justin that afternoon. The next morning, they called me and said, my husband answered the phone. I thought it was family member or people, my friends interested. Nobody calls you on your fourth kid, by the way. It's like everybody's just like, I'm just having a baby. She'll be around in a couple of weeks. And it was the guy from Whole Foods. And he said, you know, the 10 cases that you guys dropped yesterday are gone. And so I said, who took them? I still didn't believe that it was that somebody was actually buying my product. We hadn't told friends that we were really doing this because I thought if it fails, it'll just be this, you know, side hustle project that, you know, we're just having a good time doing. I say we because my husband was helping me to actually develop the product. I think, you know, if you ask him, he says, you know, she was writing personal checks off our bank account like it was water. And so he decided to jump in on it. And then finally, when we had to go and deliver more cases to Whole Foods that day, he said, maybe I should have a business card, and decided to go to the store or the FedEx Kinko's and get some business cards. And he said, what should I be? And I said, I really don't even care what you are. Actually, I just had my baby and got my product on the shelf. And he said, how about chief operating officer? Here's a lawyer from Silicon Valley. He was like, it'll be really cool. We'll drive cases around and I'll be chief operating officer. I'm like, honey, do whatever you want to do. I really don't care at this point. And so he did. And, you know, 14 years later, he's still the chief operating officer. We're going on 25 years of marriage, work right next to each other. People say, how does that work? And works pretty well. And, you know, overall, I mean, growing this business, you know, I hinted at this a little bit, but the challenges of actually growing a beverage company or a food company, they're real. I mean, the large companies really own lots of shelf space to actually get into to a Safeway. We found out pretty quickly in the beverage category, the sort of, they sell off who actually is the category captains, they're called. And so Pepsi, the year that we really wanted to get into Safeway, owned the category captain slot, and it was $60 million to actually own that category. So I started to really get an education early on around not only, you know, the real estate model that existed in the space, but also how truly unfair it was for consumers who really wanted to get healthy. Because I used to go into grocery stores and think that the stuff that was actually promoted or the stuff that, you know, called itself diet or low fat or whatever it was actually the stuff that was better in some way. And what I didn't realize was that the decks are so stacked against consumers who are really just trying to shop for their family and get healthy. So we continued on our journey in getting into sort of healthier stores. As I mentioned, Whole Foods was an early customer of ours in the Bay Area. And then we went to our first trade show. Everybody from Whole Foods was lining up saying, like, this is exactly the product that we want. And we went pretty quickly across the U.S. In Whole Foods. Also some markets like Woodlands. They were one of our first markets as well. And, you know, there were just so many things along the way, including trying to figure out things like distribution, how to actually create a shelf-stable product that markets wanted to have. So unless you have a product that can actually stay on the shelf for more than a few weeks, your chances of actually growing this company into a significant business is limited. We never had any preservatives in our product and still don't have any preservatives in our product, but we were the first shelf-stable product that actually figured out how to create a product without any preservatives. You may have heard the story before and some of the stuff that's been written, but I almost gave up on this company about a year into actually developing the company because I thought there were so many problems. It was so hard. There were so many, I couldn't figure out the puzzle. And a friend said, I know a very senior executive at Coca-Cola, maybe you could call him and actually try and figure out how to produce this product. And, you know, maybe you could even get it on their trucks. And as I reached out to him and started talking about what we were doing here in the Bay Area, he interrupted me and said, "Sweetie, Americans love sweet. This product isn't going anywhere." And I think, you know, I am so thankful for that conversation because the minute that he said that to me, I realized a couple of things. First of all, I was really like, did he just call me sweetie? And in my mind, I kept thinking, oh, he's from Atlanta. Maybe that's what it is. I don't know. But I also really realized that, you know, the soda companies are on a mission to actually sell sweet and sell sugar. And that is not what I believed 14 years ago and do not believe today that consumers really want. And so very quickly, I sat on the phone with him for another 45 minutes and said, you know, it's, you know, really great to talk to you, but I totally disagree with everything that you're saying. I don't think this is this consumer that I'm seeing in the Bay Area. He poo-pooed the Bay Area and he said, you know, isn't that where the Grateful Dead came out of? Like, you guys have no idea what you're talking about. I think about a year later, I was in a deck, a Coca-Cola deck with overalls on and my hair was in pigtails. Like I was some, you know, I don't know, woman that I guess wears pigtails and overalls. They photoshopped it in, which I thought was really funny. Really trying to diminish what I felt was like a trend and people trying to get healthy and water, which I think is very much here today. And we continued to build, really realized early on that Coke and Pepsi would not be great partners for us. It's not that they haven't spoken to us over the years, but really believed that what they put on their trucks, on the big, you know, red trucks in particular, is really products that are trying to get people addicted to sweet. And I saw that super clearly and thought, like, I don't know how we're going to be able to build this thing without them, but we've got to be able to do it. And so today we're the largest independent beverage company in the country that does not have a relationship with Coke and Pepsi or Dr. Pepper Snapple. Yeah. And, you know, it's been hard, you know, it's as, you know, I tell my four teenagers who all, you know, want to be passionate and want to be problem solvers. And, you know, I love what I'm doing every single day. And I also believe that if you can do it in the name of health and actually help people, I get emails from people almost every day telling me how this product has actually changed their life, which, by the way, I never got when I was at AOL. I never got when I was at, you know, Time. And so it's, and by the way, I mean, some of those letters are as simple as, you know, I work at Google and I never used to drink water and I started drinking your water and I no longer have type 2 diabetes. I drink your water and it helps me drink water and I think I can actually run faster. Like, these are the kind of things where there's hope. There's, you know, there's change. We don't make any claims, health claims, but we've got so many customer testimonials saying that I'm able to do this because of you guys, which is such a powerful thing to be the leader of a company that's doing that kind of stuff. So real quickly, and then we'll probably go into questions. The, you know, hot topic about a year and a half ago was, you know, the crazy executive who started a beverage company. I think this rumor was started by the soda companies in particular because they thought they had figured out what I was doing. And then I decided to launch a sunscreen product. So I had basal cell skin cancer on my nose. I was not the thing that you want to hear when you have a growing company and, you know, mother, not the thing that anybody, I guess, wants to hear, but I certainly didn't want to hear it. I had it removed once, had it removed twice. I don't have a lot of fat on my nose, so my dermatologist was like, your next stop is the plastic surgeon, and this is not going to be a good situation, so you got to get serious about wearing sunscreen. I started asking whether or not sunscreen was the right thing to wear. I have some friends in Marin County who didn't think that it was. I started looking at mineral-based products. Should I wear 50? Should I wear 15? I went into this sea of sunscreen products inside my local CVS, and I thought, what do I do? And started doing a lot of research, ran across this ingredient called oxybenzone, which was really, really scary to me. It's gotten a lot of attention with the whole Hawaii reef issue going on lately, but that's not why we removed oxybenzone. Oxybenzone in 1978 was called out by the Center for Disease Control to the FDA, and they were recommending that it not be approved by the FDA because it could exacerbate precancer cells living underneath your skin. So I was like, that's me. Girl, redhead, growing up in Arizona. You know, I've been trying to wear sunscreen for so many years. I've been putting it on my children for so many years. And I thought, this is terrible. Started reading about mineral-based products as well. And talking to, probably my favorite thing to do is the number of doctors from all over the world who I've been able to reach out to and tell them, you know, what I'm really trying to do around sugar and sweeteners. I now started doing it around ingredients and sunscreen. And some of the oncologists that I talked to said that there's a correlation between things like pancreatic cancer and liver cancer and how much women in particular are absorbing these minerals into their organs. You know, basically coinciding with some of the mineral-based makeups and some of the things that, you know, again, we're being told are healthier and better for you. So I finally decided that I was not going to use mineral-based sunscreen. It also kind of made me itch. I don't have dark skin, but for people who have darker skin, I also felt like sometimes it made them look purple. So I wanted to find a product that didn't have bad chemicals. I reminded myself that water is actually a chemical as well. So, you know, for those who hear me speak about sunscreens and I say we're a chemical-based sunscreen, it's always says, whoa, like, what did you say? I thought I'm not supposed to be wearing chemical-based sunscreens. And anyway, I decided I'm going to, you know, develop this sunscreen. I talked to my dermatologist, Kathleen Welsh, in the city, and I said, you know, I want to do this without oxybenzone, and I want to do it without parabens in it. And you know, she thought it was crazy. I found a great sunscreen, actually, that was available in her office. It's called Elta, but it was $48 a bottle. So that was also a key thing that I thought, even if you could afford $48 a bottle, that's kind of a price point that kind of limits people, and it's really not fair to force people who want to wear sunscreen to buy a product that expensive. So I went back to my kitchen, bought a lot of ingredients, and just started making my own sunscreen. And I had fruit from my water in my kitchen and an extract, and I decided to pour it into the sunscreen. And just because I thought, what's wrong with scent? That was a whole other topic that I asked people, like, why do you wear unscented? And there was a lot of things with, like, fragrance, and, you know, we don't really know what that product is. Again, I really hadn't stayed that close to sunscreens along the way. And so all sunscreens take FDA approval. So that was a whole other topic. I downloaded the forms off the internet and applied for FDA approval. I asked my lawyer. She told me it was going to be like $30,000 to have her do it. And I was like, oh, that's dumb. I'm just going to, like, do it and see what happens. And I did it, and then got a call from the FDA about 6 weeks later. I was really excited that the FDA called me, and, you know, I had never gotten a call from the FDA before. And the FDA said, we just wanted to know, are you using real fruit in your sunscreen? And I said, yeah, have you heard of Hint Water? No, we've never heard of Hint Water. Okay, so you know, I'm really excited. You know, we are using real fruit. And the gentleman that I talked to on the phone said, that's actually the wrong answer. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, so sunscreens actually don't use real fruit. They use fragrances. The fragrances often are not from real fruit. Sometimes, you know, very similar to what they're using in food products. You know, my favorite is beaver anus gland extracts and lots of other things. And I was like, this is horrifying. Like, why don't people know this stuff? And anyway, I wasn't sure whether or not I was going to get the approval. And 1 year later, I got the approval. I never thought of Hint as really a platform at this point. A lot of people ask me that question. And basically got the approval for the Hint sunscreen, and we launched it nationwide in Target, in CVS as well, and online on our direct-to-consumer business, which was very, very exciting. Target story, I'll tell you really quickly. Target doesn't launch new products. They launch products when you, like, are successful in some other place. So we were in there with our water, and we decided to give it to the sunscreen buyer. And the sunscreen buyer said, no, you know, we're not interested in your sunscreen. Thank you very much. And she called us back a week later after taking our samples to Mexico with her. And she said, you know that it's the first vacation that I've ever taken my kids on that I didn't get in a fight with them because of your sunscreen. So they actually use the sunscreen, and I really think it's the scent. And it comes in pineapple, grapefruit, and pear. And so she said, we want to put it in nationwide, and today, and we're actually going in there in a bigger way this year, which will be very, very exciting. So that was really, after the success last year of really seeing what was happening, we decided it actually really is a brand that is a trusted brand for health. And what other categories can we actually look at? We're getting ready to launch deodorant in the next couple of weeks, calling attention to aluminum. There's two things about that. My dad passed away about 6 years ago from Alzheimer's. And so when incredibly smart guy, so creative, so great, when he passed away, I really started to look into Alzheimer's. And the consistent thread across Alzheimer's research is aluminum. So we don't produce our product in aluminum cans because all aluminum cans are lined with BPA and styrene, which are also questionable. That was removed from plastic bottles years ago. It's still in 100% of cans today. But I really started to look at what are we doing as a society, you know, telling our young kids, you know, start wearing antiperspirant at age 13 so you don't smell. Again, consumers just don't really understand what they're actually asking people to do. The other thing that we've really focused on over the years is class one allergens. We don't use, our products don't touch any class one allergens. So I happen to be allergic to coconut. Coconut is a class one allergen. So if products have any coconut in it, if I ingest it, I could go into shock. If I put it on my skin, which is on in so many products now, I'll, you know, could swell up in some way, which I can get down pretty fast with a Benadryl. But it really bothers me that products are not transparent about all of these different ingredients. And so our commitment to consumers is that we don't do any of our products near peanuts. We don't do any of our product near coconuts and any class one allergens as a whole, which I think we will actually be the first natural deodorant that doesn't use, typically you're using coconut as a base. So that will be the real differentiator in our product. So it's very exciting. I love what I do. I love, you know, creating stuff where people can actually live a healthier lifestyle and potentially kick them off to be as healthy as they want to be. So so I'll leave it for questions. Yeah, thanks for listening.
Well, I hope that you'll get a chance to ask a question because I have about 50. So, but I'll try and let you ask a few. So I'll start off, so get ready. And students especially, I hope that you'll ask questions. If I was going to do a word cloud of what you talked about, you must have said the word crazy the most.
Yeah.
And I love that because you said you like working for crazies, but you also talk about your style is a little crazy. So talk a little bit about when you're hiring, are you looking for people who like crazy?
Yeah, you know, I was just telling somebody this yesterday who was trying to fill their team and from another company. And I said that, you know, it's interesting when I look around, we have 145 people in the company now. We have over on Union Street, has anybody seen our offices on our signs on Union Street? That's actually our corporate headquarters. We have four storefronts that we've turned into offices. We sell out of our office, so it's all legit. We're actually taking another one around the corner on Fillmore Street. But there are, I think, only two people who, of the 145, have actually worked for a soda company in the past, which is really interesting. Most of the people who have come to work for us, and frankly, in the Bay Area, chosen to work for us, have really figured out that we've helped them in some way. I mean, we have five former addicts in the company. If you walked in, you know, they don't necessarily fit the profile, what somebody may look at in an addict, but really believe that there's companies, and not just alcohol companies, but pharmaceutical companies that are really out to get people. So, you know, we are probably the number one product at Betty Ford, for example. So people have, you know, really started a relationship when they're going through something tough and then wanting to work with us. So I would say that passion and craziness and people that kind of think versus, I think that the biggest challenge with so many of these companies, so many of these large companies, is that you go in, you know, and you get a job there and you're taught that this is how you do things. This is how you bottle a product. This is how, you know, every product needs to have preservatives in it. So we want people that are actually thinking differently and asking the question why, I think more than anything else.
And purpose, it sounds like.
Purpose, but also, Yeah, I mean, I think really feel like they're contributing to something that is much bigger. I mean, I think over the last few years, in particular, when we see the analyst reports on some of these large soda companies, and water is really the number one thing that they're selling. I mean, we celebrate inside of our company because it's actually, you know, ticking away at what they're actually trying to do. So,
all right, questions. Oh, yes.
So at the beginning you said that. Yeah. At the beginning, you said that that you were looking to do something in the philanthropic world, mm-hmm. as to sort of do good, and now Hint has sort of is now social good, right? You're doing work for public good. Does the company also have an element of sort of more traditional philanthropy, a corporate foundation or anything? And if so, what organizations are you supporting to be consistent with what you're doing?
So two answers to that. One, we've always supported, you know, so many events. As you know, as what I've realized is that everybody needs water at their events. So we've done everything from work with Nike to Revlon to we've typically tagged on to their initiatives. So breast cancer, you know, ADD. We've been hugely supportive in not just the fires around the Bay Area that have been happening in Northern California, but also in Houston. I think we were probably the first water company down there. We actually tried to commit a lot of water to Flint, Michigan, and it was rejected. So, which was a whole other, you know, eye-opener along the way. The other thing that we're working on that, again, I never thought I was going to be a lobbyist, and I still don't call myself a lobbyist, but a few years ago, we started getting phone calls from nutritionists inside of schools and learned that public schools, as well as Catholic schools that fall under the federal funding so they can allow low-income students to come to those schools, they have to serve milk or orange juice on the trays. It's run by the Dairy Association. The Dairy Association actually they own all of the beverage decisions on the trays for kids. They got a 25-year contract, which I still don't know how companies get a 25-year contract. They have 15 years left on their contract. So basically, the choices are milk, orange juice, or tap water. And over time, I started hearing that nutritionists didn't want tap water to be the option. They wanted bottled water or a product like Hint because many of the drinking fountains didn't smell right. Kids didn't want to drink out of them. They really wanted a different option. So today, the EPA just came out with new statistics on water on these drinking fountains, and 43% of drinking fountains in the U.S. today are tainted with too high levels of lead, arsenic, or copper. So we went to Washington in August and met with Kamala Harris, Dianne Feinstein, very bipartisan, 8 different senators who all said, okay, I get it. There's drinking fountains are not actually regulated by the FDA, which is also a huge epiphany for me. They're supposed to be monitored by the states, but there's no compliance, there's no forced compliance for states to actually test the drinking water as well. So we sat down with the Dairy Association in August and said, listen, you know, we have all this data that shows that when consumers are actually making decisions about should I have milk or should I have water, like, that's not the decision that they're necessarily making. If you're going to have milk, you're going to have milk. We're not competitive with you. We're much more competitive with orange juice. And we also want to be the option for people. And again, it's not just Flint, Michigan that we're talking about. We're talking about, you know, across the U.S. and frankly in Washington, D.C., it's some of the worst water. It's closer. It's actually over 70% of drinking fountains in schools in Washington, D.C. It's really sick and crazy on a lot of levels. So we're actually trying to take this whole issue to Congress with the shutdown. It's been delayed and delayed and delayed. While this whole thing was happening in December, the Dairy Association actually got chocolate milk back on the menu. So that was removed under the Obama administration, and now your kids can actually have chocolate milk as well as plain milk and orange juice, but still no water. Is that philanthropy? We're not going to make any money. We've offered to like give it to them truly at cost at the schools if we can get it in there. Our hope is to actually, there's many, many food service directors that want to order our product. They also, you know, want to order just plain water as well. I think the scary thing with plain water is that they don't go through the processes that we go through. We heat our product, we pasteurize it, reverse osmosis, high filtration. Unlike some of these bottled waters that you buy, they're just turning on the tap and it's a cold fill process. So if there's arsenic in our water, if there's lead in our water, you're not going to be able to remove that. There's no other beverage company that's there in Washington trying to change this stuff, which I think is really interesting. We're also, you know, pretty vocal about ingredients and beauty products too. And again, my goal is not just to keep our formulas inside our nice little office on Union Street, but actually to help large companies potentially change and reformulate. We had the executive team from Estee Lauder come into our office and talking to us about how did this happen? Like, how did a beverage executive create a product in San Francisco, not in New York, that is that doesn't have any oxybenzone in it and no parabens in it? And I showed them. I said, it's not that hard. And then, you know, they said, well, we've got to reformulate so many products in order to do that. So this will be very, very difficult for us to do. But again, like, I think that for us is also philanthropy. The one other thing that I get asked a lot is the plastics question and sort of what we're doing around there. We've actually reduced the plastic in our product by 40% since we initially came out with this product. We actually were the first product and still one of the only products where underneath the cap, the closure, we don't use liners in the product. So if your cap has a liner in it, it's actually not recyclable. It's something that we're not really talking about for the oceans, but it's a huge issue. So most bottles, most people think, okay, I'm going to put my cap back on and throw it in the recycling. Don't do that. Because this part is actually not recyclable if it has a liner in it. So our bottle is 100% recyclable, including our labels. It's something that we're pretty proud about and also willing to sort of share the intellectual property on that with other beverage companies, unlike, you know, how we felt when we came in, where it was like, you're on your own. Your tech executives, you know, you're not going to be able to do this. But we really hope that we can actually change industry processes and actually do better for consumers, and that's what we lead with. So, yeah.
Other questions? Gentleman in the back.
Hi.
You
mentioned a lot the importance of developing your business plans. At every stop of the way, you mentioned how, you know, your success was based on a solid business plan that you developed. Do you have any advice, any books that you might have read, any podcasts that you might have been listening to, or anything like that that a college student could read or listen to as it pertains to developing business plans?
So one of my favorite books, I think I talked about this before, The Originals. Do you guys know that? It's Adam Grant. Do you guys know who Adam Grant is? He was a professor at Wharton, and he's had a number of people in his class, not me, but he's had a number of people in his class, including the founders of Warby Parker, and how they didn't actually quit their job or quit school or quit their job to actually start the company, but sort of did it as a side hustle initially. And so he talks about there's no perfect way to actually start a company. You know, you can go and join a company and kind of incubate inside of a company and then potentially spin it out, or like there's no perfect way. But I always like to hear founder stories, right, and how they got started. And I think what I've learned is, you know, passion, I think, trumps experience, every step along the way. You look at Sarah Blakely from Spanx, when she was starting her company. Spanx is a, you know, hosiery company. She couldn't get funding initially, and you know, she was meeting with all these guys down on Sand Hill Road and talking about, you know, how the hose need to like hold everything in, and they had no idea like what she was talking about. And so, you know, but she was really passionate about this and saw this problem. And so, I mean, you know, even going back to Steve Jobs, I mean, I think it's like people who are really focused on just making things better. Those are the ones that I, you know, I'm constantly looking at. I'm reading Phil Knight's from Nike, his book right now. It's like amazing, and it's so, you know, every step along the way. How I Built This, I think, is another one. Guys from NPR is another great, great one. But I mean, I think that's the thing that you hear over and over again, that it's not a straight line. You know, there's good days and there's bad days. I think as you, as much information that you can, you know, there weren't podcasts when I started this company, right? Like now I could just sit there and, you know, be on a plane for 5 hours and be totally entertained by, you know, the different podcasts that I'm reading. But I think, again, it's looking at it as a journey, looking at it as a puzzle. How do you solve those things? Staying close to your customers, I think, is really important. That's something that, you know, hopefully somebody will write along the way about how we're building this company on Union Street. I was just telling another company yesterday that is spending a ton of money inside of WeWork and like three times the amount that they would be spending on a, you know, storefront on Union Street, the number of consumers that come into our, you know, store, and I just start talking to them. I'm half of them don't know I'm the CEO of the company, and I ask them why, like they like our product. It's just, it's a, you know, it's a way to really have that conversation and build community. I also think social media too. Not a lot of CEOs are using social media today, but I think the ones that are, you can really ask questions pretty quickly, whether it's through LinkedIn or whether it's through Twitter. I'm on Twitter a lot. I used to hate Twitter, and then 2 years ago I had a light bulb go off on Twitter, and I love Twitter. I have a lot of people who communicate with me through Twitter, like as they're growing their company. So lots of different ways. So
other questions? So yes, go ahead.
You had talked about your new podcast, Unstoppables. What has been your favorite interview, and what is your inspiration for that?
So I interview, so the podcast actually started, I would have, you know, lunch or breakfast. There's so many entrepreneurs in the Bay Area, and I would just talk to people about, you know, crazy things like, you know, getting fired from their own company, or not being able to raise money, or all of these things that I was, you know, I've always been the person to ask the questions that nobody else wants to ask. Like, you really did? You asked her like how it felt to be fired, or, you know, and so people would say to me, gosh, I wish I would have been a fly on the wall, and I wish I, you know, would have been there when you were talking to her about this. And so I decided to start kind of videotaping those, and then ultimately doing a podcast on it. But I also, my passion side of me and sort of trying to figure out lots of stuff. I also just recently interviewed probably one of my favorite ones, Marion Nessel, who was actually with the FDA years ago when they were trying to figure out the whole cigarette issue. And she's written a lot about Big Sugar and some of the other issues that are out there. Also made me super aware a few years ago about what happens when companies actually fund research studies. So one thing she talks about on the podcast, which was super fascinating, if you're a doctor, for example, up at UCSF and you want to do a study on stevia, you have to go back to UCSF as a tenured doctor and or on staff doctor there. You have to go back to UCSF and say, I'd like some funding to do this study on stevia. And so UCSF will go out to some of their partners. They have some pharmaceutical companies that have agreed to actually fund studies. Pepsi is a big funder of different studies. And so they run the study on stevia, and then they decide that they don't, the results are inconclusive. They don't have to show the results. You know, they are basically, maybe they didn't like the results, and so they just decide, nothing happened. It was inconclusive. So that messaging for a public company, I have a problem with, right? I think you should actually have to release studies and show really smart people out there what these studies say. And there could be people reading those studies that may have different opinions than maybe the doctor who actually makes products for type 2 diabetes, for example, that doesn't actually want to release these kind of results. So Marion has been really tuned me into a lot of this stuff, and it could be another lobbyist project that we're working on to actually, you know, allow consumers to really get more information. So, but it's fun. You should definitely download it and listen to it, and it's been really great. So it's called Unstoppable with Kara Golden. There's a few Unstoppables. So I'm in the process of writing a book too, about in my spare time. It's taken me 2 years to do it, but I'm pretty close to being finished. So hopefully we'll have it out in the fall. That really is just talking about the journey and lots of stuff that you guys got to hear today.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Hello.
And she's on a wellness committee, and she's always looking for a wonderful activity. And I can't think of a better activity than to grab 25 physicians and tour your facility and talk to you. Is that a possibility?
Yeah, I mean, in San Francisco, it's just offices, so mm-hmm. It's not that exciting. We actually co-pack all over the U.S., our closest co-packer in the Bay Area is Sacramento. It's not that far, but it's that's the closest one.
Okay.
So,
well, there's a lot of info out there right now. The stuff that happened in Flint, Michigan, with the lead in the water, that was catastrophic. And then recently in the news, we've heard there's 12 or so toxins in the water that everybody's been absorbing. So all of a sudden, priority level's gone up quite a bit in my mind. So thank you for this.
Yeah, it's it is really scary. Actually, it's I think water is something that most doctors who are tuned into this are pretty afraid of. I was just talking to a doctor up at UCSF who is a bladder oncologist and huge fan of Hint and gets her patients to drink lots of Hint and wanted to meet me. And I said to her, so who gets bladder cancer? People who have had, you know, bladder infections over the years, and you know, who gets this? And she said that the majority of her patients are coming from places where we have crops, so Lodi, Gilroy, the number one thing under autopsy that they're seeing is that arsenic levels are incredibly high. So, you know, whether you're working on these farms or, you know, you're eating products, you know, the strawberries and lots of other stuff, it's everybody's focused on the pesticides. And you know, there was a great article in the New York Times, I think in December, on, you know, water as a whole, and the Trump administration was saying that he was not going to regulate the native lands and the water that's running through there. It's a beautiful picture of Arizona in the New York Times talking about this. And, you know, as somebody said, the writer from the New York Times said, you know, does Trump realize that all the waterways connect in North America somehow, right? So if we're not, you know, taking the Northern Arizona, Navajo, you know, waterways and actually making sure that they don't have some kind of process to them, then they'll eventually, you know, contaminate. And we've got a huge issue. Arsenic is something that is in a lot of the pipes too. So it used to be well water was where you'd find the most arsenic. So in places where like in New Hampshire and in mining areas in West Virginia, those were the areas, but somehow, you know, our land is too high levels of arsenic now. So get rid of arsenic by reverse osmosis. You can put it on your, you know, thing at home, your faucet at home. But it's become a huge priority for me, you know, as I've started to look at more and more details and talk to more and more doctors about this. Because, you know, it's just, you start getting these, you know, bladder cancer, liver cancer, pancreatic cancer, and, you know, you're just trying to get better, right? But why aren't more and more people talking about this? And, you know, in just one more quick thing, I mean, everybody knew about Flint, Michigan, which is not cleaned up yet. The guy who runs all of education for the state of Michigan actually turned off all of the drinking fountains in Michigan in early September. Really interesting guy basically said, like, we don't have the money in Michigan to actually clean up these drinking fountains, but I don't want to give these kids water that I know is tainted with something. So I encourage you to ask your schools in your area. It's a report that, again, is not, if you call your local school and you ask them, most of them have done the work. But it's pretty frightening. Like I said, in Washington, D.C., I've spoken about this, and people have emailed me the next day saying, I couldn't believe it. Like, you know, in major towns like Georgetown, like where they're supposed to be like great communities, there's $4 and $5 million houses, and we've got, you know, terrible high levels of lead and arsenic running through there. Like, what are we doing? So...
We have no more time for questions. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Thank you so much for listening, you guys. And if anybody wants to email me, it's Kara@drinkhint.com. So, and come by Union Street as well and drink hint and tell your friends.
We're so grateful for all that you're doing to protect public health and our individual health.
Thank you.
You are achieving your purpose of making a huge difference.
Thank you so much.
So now it's my pleasure to bring up another woman entrepreneur. Her name is Elizabeth Gore, and she founded a company called Hello Alice, and she has an exciting announcement to share with us. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you. Don't worry, this is 2 minutes. Hi, Kara. What Kara did not mention is she's also an unbelievable advocate for other women founders and has given me advice for, I think, 8 years now in my career. So thank you. So I live up in Sonoma County in Healdsburg, and we are hosting an event that I really appreciate Cynthia's leadership on. As you guys might have seen, our area, what I call just the second you step over the Golden Gate Bridge, has been hit by droughts, fires, and floods. And the folks impacted the most are actually small and medium business owners. And so we are about to hit the 2 years after the fires, and our insurance stops if you're a business owner at 2 years. So we're about to have a pretty heavy impact. They say as much as the 2 weeks following the original fires. And then you probably just saw from Marin up to Sebastopol, a lot of business owners just got hammered with the flood. So March 27th, we are hosting a significant summit, a half-day summit for business owners. Not just those who have been directly impacted by the disasters, but anyone who's really looking to grow their business in 2019. And this is really for folks who are in a business and probably within the first 5 years of their business and are operating in the North Bay. So Marin, Sonoma, Napa, and so on. So you can look it up. I've got cards for everyone. They look like this on the outside table, or you can just Google Growth Tour North Bay. This is a free event, and it's pretty exciting. We've got the new CEO of Salesforce, who is actually from Sonoma, coming back to keynote, the head of Apple California. But most of all, we have awesome business owners who are from here in Marin and Sonoma County, running restaurants, running agriculture. We just landed the newest, fastest growing cattle operator, who's an amazing woman, Jamie Mickelson. And then also we'll have very specific of how do you prepare your business for a disaster, whether you are directly impacted physically or your receipts are going to go down, or like Marin, you are suddenly being hosting thousands of people who can't go to their local business. So I'd really appreciate if y'all not only joined us, but also spread the word, because we really want to help as many people as possible. And again, I'm at Hello Alice, and you can look it up there, helloalice.com. This event is free unless you want to make a donation to fire recovery with great partners. So please do join us. I'll hand out cards. There's also cards right outside. And thank you, Cynthia, for letting us talk about it.
Thank you. Thank you, Elizabeth, for being here today, and we want to support our small businesses. Thank you, Bank of Marin, for making this possible for us, and we really appreciate it very much. And to all of our partners, thank you. I wanted to make sure you were aware that we have our next Business Edge briefing. It's on your table. If you take a look at this. We have an opportunity for those of you who are here today, a thank you. If you'd like to come to the breakfast, you can actually get a 50% discount by using the thank you code, and we hope that you will join us and tell your friends and colleagues. I wanted to mention that this program is been podcast on our Penguin Radio, which is radio.dominican.edu, so you can hear it again. Thank you so much, Stuart, for your support, for being here and recording us today. I want to thank Corey Colburn and her team, her production team, Jennifer Bellingham, Jackie, and is Manny still here, for helping us to make this happen today. This is not a simple effort to bring 50 people here to have a wonderful breakfast. Thank you so much for your support. And thank you, Kara, for being... You know, there's two people in my life I love so very much. I'm a fan of Barbara Streisand, which I sing all the time, Barbara Streisand, and you. I have to say a little story. My students know it. I have a subscription to Hint. It comes to my home here, and it comes to my home in New York. I have a cool story about it. In my home in New York, you can't drive. You have to walk. It's on a boardwalk. And I hire people to carry my Hint water to my house because that's all I drink. And it's true. I've had the same experience as you've described. I drink so much water now. I never did before, and I don't drink anything sugary because of your vision. Thank you so much for being here. And thank all of you, and have a wonderful day.